Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the geopolitical implications of the indictments of 14 top FIFA officials that has Russia's president accusing the US of meddling outside of its jurisdiction as Putin defends the embattled head of FIFA, Sepp Blatter, who is up for re-election on Friday and is facing calls to resign from world leaders, sponsors and prominent players. Daniel Treisman, a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia, joins us to discuss the likelihood that as more details about the corruption-riddled soccer organization emerge, that pressure will build to revisit FIFA's decision to award the 2018 World Cup to Russia. Then we will speak with Andrei Markovits, the author of Offside, Soccer, and American Exceptionalism, and Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. He joins us to discuss FIFA's monopolistic domination of football, as it is known in most of the world, or soccer, as it is called in the United States, and whether the Union of European Football Associations, UEFA, could break away, since UEFA's president, Michel Platini, told a press conference Thursday that he had already called on the FIFA head to resign, but Blatter refused, leaving Platini to fume to reporters, "I'm disgusted, I've had enough, enough is enough." Then finally, we'll get an assessment of the religious right's influence in the Republican primaries with Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and the author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. With presidential candidate Scott Walker belonging to a church whose members speak in tongues and believe the apocalypse is imminent, and Ted Cruz's father and campaign surrogate, a practicing dominionist, we'll discuss the role of theocrats in the presidential primaries. And joining us now is Daniel Treisman, who's a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia, a recipient of fellowships from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation and the German Marshall Fund of the United States. He's the author of Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev, and has an op-ed at the New York Times, The New Dictator's Rule by Velvet Fist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Treisman.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And President Vladimir Putin of Russia is defending the embattled Sepp Blatter, who is up for a vote on Friday as to whether he remains head of this scandal-plagued organization, FIFA, that's just had 14 of its top officials indicted. There have been calls from the British Prime Minister for Blatter to step down. Most of the major sponsors who've given them millions over the years are also calling for Blatter to step down or calling for the contracts to be reviewed. Prominent players are also coming out calling for Blatter to step down and for the organization to be cleaned up. But Vladimir Putin is defending Blatter and basically blaming all of the problems on the United States for meddling outside its jurisdiction. How much longer do you think, that as more details of the scandal come out, can Putin maintain this position?
Well, I think he's going to maintain it as long as he possibly can, and he takes this very personally. He sees this as an attempt to undermine the Russian hosting of the 2018 World Cup, and clearly he sees it in the context of general U.S. Criticism and opposition to him and to his policies around the world, in particular in Ukraine. So I think he's doing this in part for domestic public opinion, but he's going to stand by his friends and support the leadership of FIFA as long as he possibly can.
So in terms of the inquiries, though, it was very clear that the new Attorney General of the United States, in announcing the indictments of the nine that were arrested, seven of them in Switzerland, there's apparently a prominent American official of FIFA who is informing on them. He's apparently dying of colon cancer and has been wired in various meetings and has provided the FBI with a lot of information. And they made it pretty clear in the press conference that this was only just the beginning. So as the rats desert the sinking ship, so as to speak, isn't it likely, Daniel Treisman, that there's just going to be more and more sleaze coming out of the investigation about FIFA and how it makes deals? And won't this shine a light on the 2018 Olympics deal with Russia, or not to mention the one with Qatar, that most people don't understand to begin with? How can you play soccer in a triple-digit heat?
Right. Well, I understand that the authorities in Switzerland have taken some documents relating to both of those bids. And so, yes, I clearly there was a lot of preparation in this investigation. Clearly, the American prosecutors must have considerable information already, documents, testimony from people. And so I would expect that as things move forward, we'll hear a lot more about just how those bids were made and how those bids won. It really comes after a lot of doubt has been cast on the Olympic, the International Olympic Committee. It really creates this image that the whole international sport world is incredibly corrupt. And it's very sad, very unfortunate.
Well, it's more than image. It's a reality. I mean,
so it seems, but obviously we'll know more precisely as this prosecution, this investigation continues, and as court cases are tried.
So just to focus on the geopolitics, which I think we're just beginning, I think, for another round, and there's obviously a real division between the U.S. and Russia, and between Obama and Putin. They used to talk a lot on the phone. I don't know that they even speak much now. And some analysts of Russia that I've spoken to say it's not a healthy situation. The situation is so, positions are so hardened now that there's virtually no communication, and that's not good between two powerful nuclear-armed states. My sense is that this is likely to lead to yet another scandal, another reason for the U.S. and Russia not to cooperate. And again, it's something that Putin's going to take very personally.
Yes, he already is taking it personally. Any international event that is initiated by the U.S. and seems to have negative consequences for Russia, he's going to take it as a direct attack, of course. Communications between Russia and the U.S., I think, yeah, they're definitely much less than they used to be. They're very hostile, but there is some communication still going on, obviously, between Secretary Lavrov and Secretary Kerry. I think there's no way to improve that relationship in the short run, and you have to be careful about not sustaining Putin, helping him present this image of global importance at home. I think the recent meeting with Kerry was played in the Russian press and on Russian TV as a kind of victory for Putin, that despite the conflict over Ukraine, the Americans were coming to visit and to reopen discussions. So we need to preserve what channels of communication exist, but we have to be very careful, knowing that everything we do will be used by the Russian propaganda machine to try to make Putin look better.
And again, I'm speaking with Daniel Treisman, who's a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia. He's a recipient of fellowships from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation and the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and is the author of Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev, and he has an op-ed at the New York Times, The New Dictator's Rule by Velvet Fist. Apparently, though, President Putin is personally hands-on involved in preparations for the 2018 World Cup. So it's not difficult to see how he could be taking this personally. But if you just go back a little bit, 13 U.S. senators last month sent a letter to the president of FIFA, Sepp Blatter, asking him to move the 2018 World Cups to another country because of Russia's annexation of Crimea and its involvement in the war with Ukraine. That was on April the 1st. Then 3 weeks later, Sepp Blatter met with Putin at Putin's big palace in Sochi on the Black Sea, and they both were quite defiant. Apparently, they have a good relationship. And Blatter said, and this is, by the way, I'm taking this from the Kremlin's website, Blatter said, if politicians are not too happy that we are taking the World Cup to Russia, I always say to them, well, you can stay home. And in Russia, we will hold the biggest World Cup ever. So I don't know what's going to happen to Blatter, but it does feel like since this organization has been reeking of corruption for so long and there's been a lot of smoke and now we're starting to see a little bit of fire, my sense is that this is not going to go away.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. Putin cares a lot about sport. He he loves putting on these big these circuses. The Sochi Olympics was for him hugely important, and it was, we have to say, a great success, despite all the carping and the negative publicity in the American media leading up to Sochi. It was a huge success, but he threw that away almost immediately, almost the day after, with his illegal invasion and annexation of Crimea and supporting the rebels in Ukraine. So he cares about these things. He has personal relationships with a lot of athletes, a lot of professional athletes. He occasionally plays hockey himself and is very active in various other ways, as we see in the magazines all the time. But it isn't going to improve unless it's almost certainly going to drag on now through the courts. And the big question is whether there will be any decision to change the venue of the 2018 World Cup. And obviously it's too early to speculate about that. But I think that would be perceived by Putin and by the Russian public as a huge negative event. The Russian public, I think, would blame the West, of course. But I think Putin also would be viewed as less effective, as failing to defend Russia's interests, and something that a lot of people really care about.
Well, but if that's not the scenario, and it's certainly a fairly likely scenario that there's going to be more pressure and more exposure of, but at this point, you know, Blatter has such a corrupt organization. He has 200 plus people from around the world that's been on his payroll from countries that barely know what soccer is. So he's got the vote sewn up, but there's tremendous pressure on him. You've got David Cameron asking for him to step down. My sense is that even if Blatter can hold on, and of course these revelations about how these deals were struck with Russia and with Qatar, all that dirty laundry is going to be aired in any case. So short of cancelling the 2018 World Cup in Russia, it's still likely, isn't it, that there could be a boycott of it. If the stench is so great, and if Blatter can hold on, and the organization itself is going to be so sullied that it's possible. I mean, the European Federation of Soccer is already calling for Blatter to step down and threatening to form their own organization. So I guess this is a long-winded way of saying that short of cancelling the deal with Russia, there's still a possibility of a boycott, isn't there?
I think that'll depend probably on the political situation as we get closer. I mean, it's an incredibly awkward situation for countries to be sending teams of sportsmen into a country that's at war with one of its neighbors. So it's possible that the Ukrainian conflict will be resolved in some way before then. But if there's that conflict continuing, or God forbid, some other kind of conflict that Russia's involved in, then I think, yes, it becomes very hard for the authorities in countries that oppose such international aggression not to boycott. Of course, there's always an argument on the other side that sports shouldn't be held hostage to politics, that the whole point of these international sporting events is to get beyond the daily political conflicts. But I think that's a reality that will have to be faced if things continue to deteriorate with regard to Russia's international behavior, and I should say also with regard to domestic repression, then there will certainly be very strong calls from various actors around the world for a boycott.
Well, the 1980 Olympics in Moscow were boycotted by the U.S. and a number of nations, and then in the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles were boycotted by Russia and a lot of nations. I'm not suggesting that the Cold War has resumed, but there is a sort of Cold War going on there, and I'm just wondering whether this sporting event has sort of entered the new Cold War politics. In other words, people are looking for ways to punish Putin for what he's done in Crimea and what he's doing in Ukraine, and they've put sanctions on him and put sanctions on the Siloviki, his circle of cronies and kleptocrats. So it's not unreasonable to suggest that maybe this is another way to punish him, since we're in the business of punishing Putin.
Absolutely. And he'll paint it as being punishing Russia. So it helps him in the short run whenever there's something which he can present as an unjustified Western attack on Russia. Of course, we would prefer to paint it as a measure to punish Putin, but he controls the way that these things are presented to the mass of the Russian people through the state media, state TV, and the whole style of state TV in the last year, 2 years, has changed dramatically to one of just blatant propaganda. So it's the sort of event which, on the one hand, does reduce this image of global importance, of international respect for him personally, which I think is a problem for him, but at the same time, it does play into this sense of Russia being victimized by the West, which uses every pretext to try and reduce its power and reduce its prestige.
Well, the propaganda control that Putin has is so extraordinary that he's now made it illegal to talk about any Russian casualties in Ukraine. It's a state secret now.
Right.
And that was, to some extent, his Achilles heel. That was what Boris Nemtsov, the opposition politician who was gunned down just in the shadow of the Kremlin, he was about to release a list of Russian casualties in Ukraine. So there you have it. I mean, it's
I suppose he's worried about this, that he understands that the public is definitely in favor of having Crimea back for free without casualties, without significant economic cost, but is much more wary about any kind of foreign engagement which will cost lives and money.
So, well, just in closing then, if 2018 the games go ahead in Russia, and, you know, there's obviously a lot of concerns about the safety of Russian airlines flying tourists east of the Urals into various venues that they would have, and they wouldn't all be in Moscow and St. Petersburg. But that aside, you've got elections coming around that same time, don't you? And you just mentioned earlier that it'd be a lot easier for countries to boycott the World Cup if Russia were at war with Ukraine. So I guess that's on the plus side. At least things would be quieter around that time. Not that the damage hasn't been done, because Putin has basically turned these two friendly countries against each other. The Ukrainians hate the Russians now, which they never did before, and that's hardly a step forward.
We don't know what's going to happen. Since Putin went into Crimea, I've stopped trying to predict what he's going to do next, because he's done a series of things which were quite unexpected. So we don't know. We can hope that that he'll see it as in his interest to try and calm down the situation in Ukraine and end the war, but we don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But that's right, 2018 is just at the peak of Russia's next electoral season. So the parliamentary elections will already have been held, but the presidential election is due for 2018, shortly before the start of the World Cup, if I remember right. So, yeah, he's going to be sensitive to international pressure. He obviously would try to use it in his favor if he can present Russia as being slapped in the face by a condescending world. But there's no way that this can be kept out of politics, both domestic Russian politics and also international politics.
Well, Daniel Treisman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Treisman, who's a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia, a recipient of the fellowships from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation and the German Marshall Fund of the United States. He's the author of Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev, and he has an op-ed at the New York Times, The New Dictators Rule by Velvet Fist. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into whether the European Football Association will break away from the corruption-riddled FIFA. And joining us now is Andrei Markovits, who's a professor of comparative politics and German studies at the University of Michigan. He has written on topics as varied as German and Austrian politics, anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, social democracy, social movements, the European right, and the European left. His books include Offside, Soccer, and American Exceptionalism, and his latest, Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, FIFA's Recent Scandal Will Not Alter Association Football's Problems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrei Markovits.
Thank you so much for having me.
And with the head of the European Football Association, UEFA, calling, first of all, he said that he'd met with Sepp Blatter and asked him to step down, and Blatter refused. And then he had a press conference on Thursday. This is Michel Platini, and he basically was just fuming to the reporters, saying, "I'm disgusted. I've had enough. Enough is enough." So is it possible that UEFA could break away from FIFA?
It's possible, but very unlikely, and for one important reason. UEFA, or actually the European, the big leagues, I mean, the core of soccer, I mean, in terms of explaining these things, in terms of core, semi-periphery, and periphery, an important concept that explains a lot of political economy and so on, the core of this is Western Europe. And especially the big five, namely, obviously, England, Germany, Italy, La Liga in Spain, and maybe to a little lesser extent, but also very important, France. And they are the ones who import all the great players. This is the pinnacle of the game. These leagues are global entities. They make billions of dollars. Manchester United, Barcelona, Bayern Munich do not need FIFA. But because soccer, since 1904, is organized, as I always say, in a Catholic way, meaning that there is a very, very clear pyramid which has a pope, namely in this case FIFA, in this case Blatter, the head of FIFA, who decrees very clearly what is football and what isn't. And because it's these federations that govern the international, the national sides, in other words, not Manchester United, but in fact England, and because it is important in the culture of the game for every player not only to be a great player for his club, but also for his country, until FIFA has that veto power, it's almost impossible for anybody to exit, because the minute UEFA were to leave, which would be no problem for these big clubs, what they would do, FIFA would say, okay, henceforth you are not playing soccer, not playing football. You are outlaws. You cannot represent your country anymore. And as long as this is very important to these players, as long as Ronaldo will always not only love to play for Real Madrid, but important for him to get capped, as it's so nicely called in England, for Portugal, and for Lionel Messi to also wear the blue and white jersey of the Argentinian national team. And that is completely controlled by monopoly of FIFA in terms of jurisdiction. This will be a very, very hard thing to do. And so I am actually very doubtful that this will happen. I hope it. I actually think it should happen, but I just cannot see how UEFA will be able to literally establish a rival federation, a rival entity, in a context of eliminating or kind of being apart from the rest of the world. The only way that this might possibly happen, and I just find this very interesting, is by having the great, the big companies starting to enter this. Because look, the only way to have this altered is, of course, by changing the consumption side, meaning that people would, let's say, start not watching the game or not following because of these things. Well, that just isn't happening. I do not know one soccer fan anywhere in the world, and I know hundreds, who would say something like, I will not think that any Arsenal fan were to say, you know, Blatter is a crook, FIFA is a bunch of corrupt people, I will not watch the FA Cup final. It's just not happening. The game is more popular than ever before. People love it. They will watch it regardless of who these kind of distant heads are. The only other possibility would be if Visa and Adidas and these major, major players were for some reason to say, look, we might actually reconsider our sponsorships. Now, that would hurt. There's only two way of hurting it, that way or the fans staying away. The fans will not stay away. So I think that's the only possibility for kind of an exit from this, apart from the fact of cleaning up the whole mess. But I actually am very suspicious, believing in structures, that if you are in an uncontrolled monopoly, which in fact lords over perhaps the most inelastic good in the world, namely so beloved by billions, I cannot imagine that there would not be new corruption with new people coming in there. It's just too tempting. I don't think that all these guys are evil and then the new people would all be saints. It's just too corrupting, precisely because everybody wants to see it. Everybody wants to have the big tournaments, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, already Visa has said that if that FIFA needs to rebuild a culture with strong ethical practices to restore the reputation of the game for fans everywhere. Should FIFA fail to do so, we have informed them that we will reassess our sponsorship. And Adidas took a hit in its shares because it's so tight today. It's closely tied to FIFA as a sponsor. So already, in effect, the market is talking. And oh, by the way, Michel Platini, the head of UEFA, the European League, said in the press conference, "I think Blatter can be beaten." Before yesterday, no. So something's changed. Now, of course, he's got the vote hooked line. He's got the vote rigged, right? Because he pays off all these small countries, 209 members. And they're all going to vote for him, and although the UEFA people are urging that they vote for Prince Ali, the Jordanian.
Right. It's so fascinating. Isn't it so fascinating that here is the first world, the big, the rich, fat countries, who are aligned with a third world non-first world leader, in this case Prince Ali, campaigning against a Swiss, talk about a rich country, a Swiss person who is in fact backed by all Africans and Asians. It's a wonderful, so it's a great story. The only Europeans, of course, who are out of it, are obviously backing him very much, not the only, but mainly are the Russians. That's another thing, that UEFA is not, if not all 37 or so UEFA members are completely on board of departing. Russia being a very strong backer of Blatter. I think it's a fascinating thing that will happen tomorrow. I totally agree with Michel Platini, not only because I still adore him for being one of the greatest players in the 1980s or maybe ever, certainly the greatest French player, and I enjoyed watching him so much, but I agree with him that before this thing that happened yesterday, Blatter was a shoe-in. Now, I still think he will ultimately win because all he needs is 106 votes, and because it's a simple majority, and he probably will get those. I actually what I found so interesting. I mean, there's so many angles to this. The instigator of all of this is the United States, which, of course, is a mighty, mighty player in everything other than soccer, which is fascinating. In the world of soccer, the United States is a minnow, is not a player. This is not a major, it's a discussion now because of what is going on, but soccer is not part of the American sports culture the way it is in these other countries. And yet the United States plays them, is in the vanguard of this. And if you read the whole thing, it almost reminds me of, you know, when the feds went after the Gambino family. I mean, it's like, you know, basically trying to get at John Gotti. And basically, I'm always waiting for Sammy the Bull Gravano, namely the main guy who turns against him, who flips.
Well, that's already happened, though, Andre, with Chuck Blazer.
No, no, but Chuck Blazer is not a main guy.
Well, but he's given them an awful lot. He's dying of colon cancer. He's given the feds an awful lot of information.
No, I agree with you, but I think you need more than that. And ultimately, I think what this is all about, and of course, certainly what the Europeans, again, the West Europeans, I should say, and in this case, the feds, though not the American public, because it's too distant from soccer. But it's so interesting. So the here I talk to all kinds of British friends and German friends who have become the you know, to whom the FBI and Loretta Lynch has become a hero. They're hoping that now finally they will get, Blatter and all these guys will see a cameo pants. But I really think that they hope that someone will turn and have a smoking gun against Blatter.
Mm-hmm.
Because Blatter, of course, is still untouchable, and that's, of course, the real marker of major power, that your hands, of course, remain clean.
Again, I'm speaking with Andre Markowitz, a professor of comparative politics and German studies at the University of Michigan. His books include Offside, Soccer and American Exceptionalism, and the latest, Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, FIFA's Recent Scandal Will Not Alter Associations Football's Problems. Now, I think it's worth reminding ourselves, though, Andre, that the Loretta Lynch at this press conference that they had announcing the indictments yesterday made it very clear that the investigation is just beginning. The Swiss authorities have gotten apparently all of the a lot of the discs and contracts for these 2018 and 2022 Russia and Qatar deals, all made on the same day in under very suspicious circumstances.
Yes.
If we have a more and more scandals unfolding, which I think is inevitable, and it already got to the British Prime Minister Cameron calling for Blatter to go. Putin is freaked out. Obviously, he's comparing this American legal overreach to what they're doing with Edward Snowden and Julian Assange. But at the end of the day, it's not unlikely that they could undo that deal with Russia in 2018. Because the whole thing is rotten to the core, and the more you delve into this sewer and shine some light on it, God knows what you're going to find.
True. You could, of course, always argue that, any politics is ultimately a form of payola. So typically the way American urban machines worked, and, you know, the Daily Machine in Chicago being one prime example, but there are others, where basically votes were always bought. So in fact, what I'm saying is you're totally right. I agree with you fully. I really think that the Qatar thing is much more egregious than Russia. I'm not saying that the Russian thing might have not also gotten where it did by dint of complete corruption, but at least it's very clear that Russia is able to handle this. To handle this huge, by far much bigger than the Olympics event. I mean, you really need an amazing infrastructure, and it's not a city, it's a country, and so on. And Russia can do this, but Qatar, this is just a joke. It really defies any kind of logic, other than, of course, that they were bought off. So, I agree with you that this might happen, but I'm not sure whether it will happen. Even precisely under the logic of when people say, yes, my vote was bought, but, votes are bought in general, and it's basically all a give and take, right? I mean, that's what politics is. You want your party to come in, the party comes in, and, you know, when the president wins, his big donors get all kinds of fancy ambassadorships. So what I'm saying is that you need a little more than just the kind of sort of favoritism that really went on here, I think.
Well, but surely, Andre, there is more than favoritism in terms of buying the votes of where you have the next World Cup. The fact that they shake down these big sponsors like Visa and Adidas, yeah, and that these guys are regular businessmen, so they don't like dealing with mafia shakedowns. And you made the analogy yourself that this whole thing starts to look like a mafia operation. So surely when you have the mafia ratting on each other, and these big corporations like Visa, basically, and by the way, my understanding is that that MasterCard was approached before Visa got the contract, and they just didn't want to pay the bribes.
Yes.
I think all kinds of people are going to come out of the woodwork.
Yeah, maybe you're right, and maybe there will be, and that's I think that's precisely the reason why Putin, because you know ostensibly he doesn't, why is he so upset about this? Precisely because he fears that just what you just said very eloquently, that you know this can open up all kinds of whole can of worms that will ultimately lead people to renege on the commitment to hold the World Cup in Russia, and I think that's what he's worried about, and that's why he's mobilizing through the media, the hawkish media, as seeing it as kind of an American intervention or something. So it's a fascinating story on many angles. I just hope that it will come to a situation where this is cleaned up a bit. But I also think that in some ways I've always worried about FIFA's total control of the game and its complete lording over the rules and that this too should have some kind of if you look at the whole thing of a goal line technology, I mean, I could go into this. We don't have time for this, and how that was handled. It's atrocious, it's not only corrupt, but it's also sclerotic, and takes way too long, is fraught with all kinds of built-in stagnation, which need not be the case.
Well, obviously, if you got a multi-billion-dollar racket going that has no transparency and billions of dollars change hands and God knows how much Sepp Blatter is worth, he certainly is able to ladle out a lot of money to bribe these people who are going to vote for him tomorrow. I mean, criminals don't want to give up criminal empires that easily. So it's not going to be easy, but I just think it's been rotten for so long that the stench has reached a critical point.
True. But then again, I turn around and I just love the game, and this will not have one millimeter or inch or whatever you want or iota of an effect of how I will follow the sport. And nor will billions. And so it's almost like and that I think is also clearly played in their favor. Mm-hmm. Because, there was no, it's not a popular uprising. It's not, it's not what people are really, the reason Western Europe started being upset about, above all led by England, or initially, was basically sour grapes because they lost to Russia. And
people have been looking into this guy forever. It's not as if this scandal has suddenly emerged.
No. Of course.
And I'm sorry to tell you, Andre, as much as I've enjoyed talking with you, we have to leave it now because we've run out of time. But we'll catch you. We'll be talking soon, I guarantee you. Okay.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Andre Markovitz, a professor of comparative politics and German studies at the University of Michigan. His books include Offside, Soccer, and American Exceptionalism, and his latest, Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, FIFA's Recent Scandals Will Not Alter Association Football's Problems. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the role of theocrats in the Republican presidential primaries. And joining us now is Frederick Clarkson, who's a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. He's also the editor of Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and is the founder of the interactive blog Talk to Action, where he just wrote the article, The Religious Bigotry of Rick Santorum. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frederick Clarkson.
Thanks. Good to be with you again, Ian.
And the theocrats in this Republican field, which is growing all the time with Governor Pataki entering and just yesterday, Rick Santorum, obviously it's a crowded field. Is that going to dissipate the influence of the religious right, which of course is key in these early primary states like Iowa?
Quite the opposite, I think. I think as far as they're concerned, it's the more the merrier. That means there's more of their message is getting into more places. They have more leaders of some of substance and articulation, and more activists on the ground, and more money flowing into each of these places. I think it broadens their electorate rather than dilutes it.
So, but do any of these candidates have a chance, do you think? I mean, Santorum won almost as many primaries as Mitt Romney back in 2012 and won Iowa, but sort of got nowhere. It seems like the Republican establishment tolerates the theocrats in the primaries, but then the money people talk in the general.
Well, that's certainly the way the Christian right understands it, too, which is why they want to outvote them. And these are not stupid people, and they understand that electoral politics is hardball, and they have their own ways of going about it. Rick Santorum was number two against Romney last time. This was the last theocrat standing, I suppose. But, you know, some of these guys in the field are accomplished politicians. Mike Huckabee did very well in 2008. He wishes he'd run in 2012. He might have been the candidate. My goodness. I mean, everybody's standing, whether it's Ted Cruz or Rand Paul, is an accomplished politician and who are not to be underestimated.
Well, Rand Paul is not a theocrat, though, is he? I mean, he's a libertarian. I think Ted Cruz's father is definitely a theocrat. In fact, he's a Dominionist.
Yes, well, very much so. I mean, Ted Cruz is probably the scariest of the bunch in terms of his articulated theocratic vision. But, Rand Paul is whatever he needs to be. If he needs to be a little more libertarian on one day, sure. Maybe he needs to be theocratic on another day. I think he's entirely pliable. His dad, you know, was a fake libertarian who was a radical theocrat. Most of the most radical theocrats agree with Ron Paul on issues like, say, foreign policy. They might disagree with him on marijuana legalization. But make no mistake, there are different varieties of theocrat, and people should not in any way think of Rand Paul or his dad as secular libertarians.
And what about Scott Walker? His father is a preacher, and his church that he belongs to is really, really reactionary.
That's the thing that's so interesting about the people who are even the potential establishment candidates, whether it's Jeb or Scott Walker, let's say Jeb Bush. And they have legitimate Christian right credentials. And if you're a Republican these days, the challenge for you is whether you're an establishment Republican to figure out a way to appeal to conservative Christians, and if you're a conservative Christian, to figure out a way to not scare off the establishment. It's a balancing act because both sides of the party really hate and distrust each other.
So in terms of a lot of these candidates that you've mentioned, by the way, what I find extraordinary, Frederick, is that almost all of them have had their picture taken with the son of the people that have their reality show on TV, 19 Kids and Counting, Josh Duggar, the eldest son of Jim Bob and Michelle Duggar. And they have, and of course, the eldest son is no slouch in terms of theocracy because he just was forced to resign from his post as executive director of the Family Research Council's Action Fund, which is a lobbying arm of the Family Research Council. And that's a major Christian right organization. But it's pretty interesting, isn't it, that this guy who turns out to have to be a child molester, including molesting his own sisters, is now kind of, you know, being treated like a leper. But there are all these pictures of him standing there with Jeb Bush, Bobby Jindal, Rick Perry, Scott Walker, Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum, Ted Cruz. And of course, Rick Santorum has been particularly outspoken in support of Duggar. And of course, the Duggars have endorsed Mike Huckabee for president. So does this affect them in any way? I mean, there are always cases of these pious, holier-than-thou people turning out to be personally compromised, whether it's with hookers or whatever the scandal is, and this one turns out to be the guy's a child molester.
Well, it's a terrible embarrassment, obviously, for the family values crowd. For some of the politicians who happen to have their picture taken with a prominent Christian right activist, it's like, well, okay, he was a prominent Christian right activist, but they don't endorse his bad behavior. So, you know, it's not going to hurt Ted Cruz, you know. But Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum, who are doubling down on their support for Josh and for the Duggar family, becomes increasingly problematic because it means that they're not going to be able to make the issue go away. Continuing to support somebody who was a serial child molester, who was not reported by the police or by his family, and whose behavior was covered up until the statute of limitations ran out. That's criminal negligence. I mean, not criminal in the sense of the law, perhaps, but certainly in sense of the any sense of integrity when it comes to their religious family values. It's going to be really hard for both Huckabee and Santorum to deal with that.
Well, of course, a judge actually had the records destroyed of Josh Duggar's child molestation.
That's right, and a judge who was appointed by Mike Huckabee when he was governor. It smacks of the kind of kid glove treatment that Catholic bishops have been treated with, particularly Bishop Finn in Kansas City, who was a convicted felon and took several years for the Pope to remove him. He was very politically active in the conservative movement. So it's been very difficult to hold people like that accountable. But Josh Duggar is now the poster boy for that kind of double standard.
But which Pope removed this bishop?
Pope Francis.
Oh, he did?
Just a few weeks ago.
I see.
Yeah.
And even Pope Francis was slow to act, because it wouldn't have surprised me if it had been either of his two predecessors.
No, it all came out under Pope Francis, to my knowledge.
Right.
Finn wasn't personally involved in child molestation of any kind, but he basically covered up for and minimized the undisputed criminal activities of one of his priests.
Mm-hmm.
And that priest is now doing 50 years in jail.
Hmm. Well, you know, in terms of Santorum, Rick Santorum, who's a very, very fundamentalist Catholic, doesn't know that there's a new pope in town.
I don't think that the Pope is as new as a lot of us would like to wish that he was.
Well, I was using the joke about the new sheriff in town. I mean, he's at least he's already spoken out on the obsession with sex and reproduction, et cetera.
And Santorum has downplayed his own advocacy on those issues and is emphasizing a conservative version of economic populism. He supports the minimum wage and thinks that the Republican Party is wrong to focus on tax cuts for the 1%. Mm-hmm. Santorum is going to cast himself as a working man's Catholic populist.
Well, but it was only back in 2011 that Rick Santorum said, one of the things I will talk about that no president has talked about before is, I think, the dangers of contraception in this country.
The Pope, there is no light between Pope Francis and Rick Santorum on those issues.
Well, I was referring to the Pope's remarks about obsessions on sexual matters as opposed to social justice and other issues.
The Pope has not deviated from the Catholic Church line. It's really just a matter of emphasis, not a matter of doctrine.
I see.
And people are engaging in wishful thinking about this Pope in terms of these issues. He's not going to change his mind about contraception or abortion or same-sex marriage.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn to one of the other theocrats that we've been talking about, Ted Cruz. There's an amazing song that's just been released by a Christian rap group called The Watchmen. It's called Set It On Fire, which is an endorsement of Ted Cruz's run for presidency. Can we just play a clip of it?
Sure.
We are Americans. We won't let this trial be the end of us. We beat the British with nothing more than just a bunch of dissidents. We sacrificed almost 2 million of our children in the stand for liberty against the world's killers and villains. We're the greatest nation that's ever been implanted on the planet. Never panic when things get rough. We put our hands up on the granite and grind for righteousness. May we never take for granted that we're a nation under God. Without faith, we cannot stand up. The true solution is return to the roots of our Constitution. Remove this monster boot off the neck of our sovereign union. Select Ted Cruz and let's get through this. The movement, reignite the promise. If you're conservative, then prove it. Imagine the Reagan Revolution Part 2 on our fingertips. We the people are the future of our nation. Won't relinquish it. Let the American dream die? Nah, never think of it. We're on the brink of it, but we'll survive. We're Washington and Lincoln's
so
kids.
So courageous conservatives.
Rise up, roll out.
All in for the war. Can we win?
No doubt.
Ignite the promise, we haven't lost it. We're gonna see our nation rise. Rising only takes one spark to light the fire. Oh, 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 oh.
And that was, of course, a clip of the Christian rap group called The Watchmen. Their new song, Set It On Fire, which is an endorsement of the presidential run of Ted Cruz. Frederick?
Yeah, it's an extraordinary song, I think, because he's tied to prominent Christian right activists like David Lane and his pastor Rob McCoy. And he's talking about abortion on one hand, but he's also talking about a much broader and darker vision where top Christian right leaders are comparing American constitutional government to the regime in Nazi Germany and invoking people like Christian heroes like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who were involved in the attempted assassination of Adolf Hitler. Christians know this, and they know that to be like Bonhoeffer means to be involved in direct violent confrontation with the government. It's an extraordinarily sneaky and dangerous vision.
But how do they make this conflation that, as they say, many churches in Germany sang louder on Sunday mornings to drown out the sounds of wailing Jews in boxcars on the way to the concentration camps? The majority of pulpits and pews in the American churches have been willfully ignoring the stench of blatant evil rising in this once godly nation.
He's basically arguing that that evil abounds in the land, from the turning away from God's laws. He's arguing that's the way it used to be in America, and could be yet again if Christians of the right sort will waken from their complacency and rise up against the tyranny that's growing around them. Abortion is a symptom, but it's not the only issue of the crushing satanic tyranny that they see coming. And they envision a need potentially for violence and assassination and revolution in the face of this thing. I mean, when they use the Nazi analogy, they're trying to take it very seriously.
How much is Ted Cruz influenced by his father, who's a preacher and a Dominionist, somebody that actually believes? I mean, that's full-on theocracy, right? Your position is that Jesus Christ is actually the head of state, not the president of the United States.
Well, yeah. Ted Cruz was born and raised to be the kind of Christian right leader that his father dreamed of. Rafael Cruz was there at the beginning of the Christian right, as we understand it, as a member of the Religious Roundtable. And he's been there as a prominent activist from early days. So when he raised his son to fulfill that vision, Ted Cruz entered the citadels of the enemy in Princeton and Harvard, and he mastered them. And he became the Solicitor General of Texas. He's argued cases before the Supreme Court. He's a very smart and articulate man who knows how to play the legal and political game in America while also holding to the theocratic vision of his father. His father is his principal stand-in or proxy out on the campaign trail. And I've seen video of Rafael Cruz saying absolutely astounding and controversial and polarizing things, followed on the podium by Ted Cruz, and Ted just saying, well, my dad's a hard act to follow. And then he goes on to give his speech as if nothing unusual had just happened.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Frederick Clarkson, but I guess just in leaving you, you're saying that don't underestimate these guys. The religious right is not dead, even though there's a whole bunch of them clamoring for that vote.
Well, that's exactly right. And singers like the one we just heard are offering a very, very dark vision of what they think they're up against in America.
Well, Frederick Clarkson, I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me in.
And again, I've been speaking with Frederick Clarkson, who's a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and the author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. He's the editor of Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and is the founder of the interactive blog Talk to Action, where he just wrote the article, The Religious Bigotry of Rick Santorum. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm